DGS and KMOX. Even it's past 3 p.m. Happy Monday to everybody. So Art Holliday from KSDK, he and I have been pals going all the way back. And, man, I remember interviewing you. I don't even know what year it was, but when you just had the idea about the Johnny Johnson movie. That's way back at Emmett.
Well, it's 22 years and counting.
Wow.
And I've often wondered at the very beginning, after someone suggested that Johnny might be a great topic for a documentary, if someone had whispered, oh, by the way, it might take 25 years, if my response would have been different.
You might have done something else. Yeah, that's something else.
Well, you don't get time in television to tell a story, so, you know.
Yeah. This
is that's kind of what attracted me to long-form storytelling anyway. Most of my stories in TV news are between a minute 30 and occasionally 3:30.
Yeah.
And this allows you to do so much more and have so much more nuance and detail and history. And, you know, so it was kind of a no-brainer the more I thought about it, starting with the fact that Johnny was in the delivery room when rock and roll was born.
That's right.
That alone, that and the fact that he's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, that's a great starting point.
Not only in the delivery room, he may have been the father or the mother, right? I mean, he was the guy. Art introduces to Ron.
So our pet, Ron Waterman of Story Smart, our paths crossed years ago when Ron was the marketing director for the St. Louis Cardinals. And I started reading some of his blogs about his new company, Story Smart, and it was obvious that we were both chasing the same dream of being long-form storytellers. And we connected, and we had a few conversations to see if I was a good fit for him and he was a good fit for me. And now he and his company, Story Smart, are the executive producers of Johnny B. Goode. And he's going to help me drag this thing across the finish line.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I told him, you know, we were talking about the other day, there's certain parts of making a movie that aren't the real sexy part, right? The storytelling part. There's aspects that, you know, involve spreadsheets and marketing and all of that kind of stuff. So we're going to do what we can to make sure that audiences see this story because it really is an amazing story. I mean, to your point, I mean, he may have been one of the fathers of rock and roll.
Yeah.
And he hired Chuck Berry. Like, that's the big aha I had one of the first conversations you and I had. I was like, holy cow.
Yeah.
But for him hiring Chuck Berry, where would modern music be?
So I'll bet there's a lot of people listening right now that are fans of the movie Pulp Fiction, the Quentin Tarantino classic. And what's the most memorable scene in that movie? It's the twist contest, right? With Uma Thurman and John Travolta. What's playing? What are they dancing to? You Never Can Tell by Chuck Berry. Who's the piano player playing the solo while they're doing the Batman and all the, and the twist and all that? Most people who are fans of that movie have no idea who Johnny Johnson is, but they love that scene.
Yeah.
And Johnny is front and center with the vibe of that movie, of that particular iconic scene.
Yeah. So Chuck played it, but do you think, but originated with Johnny?
Well, that's the unanswered question. That's certainly what Keith Richards said in Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll.
What a movie.
I mean, that was a huge controversy when he said that, why are so many of those songs written in guitar keys instead of piano keys? For a musician, that's a smoking gun. Does it prove anything? It certainly makes you ask the question. And, you know, one of the things that we try to address in this film is the gray area of songwriting.
Yeah.
Because depending on what musician you talk to and what band they're in, the criteria for getting credit for writing a song is different.
Amen.
And I had Ernie Isley from the Isley Brothers talked about it. He said in the Isley Brothers, everybody got songwriting credit because it kept the drama down. In other bands, it's melody and lyric, end of story.
Uh-huh.
In other bands, it's the melody and the lyric is the clay. You haven't made the statue yet.
Mm-hmm.
That's when you go in the recording studio.
Yeah.
And if someone comes up with a great part, David Sanborn is in that segment, Kirkwood's Own, right? The sax legend. And he talked about the fact that you take a song like My Girl and that bass line, boom, 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 boom. That wasn't in the original music and lyric. That happened after the fact in the recording studio.
Yeah,
but it's what we remember.
It's exactly what we remember.
Yeah. I'm getting chills for real, just like thinking about that.
You know, there are so many storylines that I get to talk about. In the same part of the film, you know, the song Wider Shade of Pale by Procol Harum. There's a very distinctive organ part that is associated with that song. Matthew Fisher was the organist. Years later, decades later, he sued the rest of the band for songwriting credit. In Great Britain, he won because there's no statute of limitations.
Hmm.
Here, the only reason Johnny's lawsuit didn't go to trial was not on the merits of the case, but because he waited too long.
Yeah. Yeah. Liberty DeVito, Billy Joel's drummer, is kind of a pal of mine. And he really suffered and ended up suing Billy and losing for similar reasons. He wasn't the Johnny Johnson.
Right.
But he felt like they were a band, because when you're young, you're a band. And then as you age, you're like, oh, okay, you get 17% of the, you know. But yeah, I mean, it's the dirty laundry of music. Who's going to get paid?
Or any creative process, right?
Yes.
That involves collaboration, right? Like, but for all of the participants, you know, movies are like that, right?
Yeah.
Like there's so many people that have to work their magic, put their craft into it.
Yeah.
And the end result is this beautiful thing. Well, what if you didn't have a colorist on your film, right? Like, what if you didn't have somebody that did the graphics or the editing, right? Like, I mean, there's so many elements that come
together. Ron, how well did you know this story when you hooked up with Art?
Not well. I mean, over the years, I heard him talk about it. You know, candidly, I knew Chuck Berry, right? Like, but he and I reconnected actually through a mutual friend of ours and a filmmaker. And, you know, the more I learned about it, I was like, holy cow, this is a story that people need to see and know. Because the issues, like, as I've watched the rough cut, like, there really are two stories here. Like, there's the story of Johnny, but there's also this sticky, I mean, you're a lawyer, right?
Yeah.
Like, the creative legal aspect. I mean, that's a really relevant topic.
Yeah. Art, do you know, did Johnny die bitter?
No, Johnny was not a bitter person at all.
He didn't seem like it.
He was, I call him a humble genius. Johnny had zero interest in trying to impress you. I mean, I remember the very first conversation I had with him, Dave. When I approached Johnny and his wife, Frances, about the idea of doing a documentary, they invited me to their home, and I quickly realized that Frances was the gatekeeper.
Mm.
You know, if I didn't pass her test, I was dead in the water. But at one point in the conversation, I said to Johnny, if we work together on this, who are some of the people that I should talk to? And you know, if you've ever been in Johnny's presence, he's got a very low voice, very monotone voice. He talks kind of slowly, and he was like, "Well, you might want to talk to Bonnie Raitt, and maybe you should talk to Eric Clapton, and yeah, you should probably talk to Keith Richards." And he just starts name dropping. And, like, doesn't everybody know these people?
Sure. Right.
And so there's a whole list of people, and luckily a lot of them said yes.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, at the time of the lawsuit, that was people around Johnny convincing him and kind of nudging him in that direction. That was not his idea.
Mm-hmm.
After Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll and Keith Richards came into his life and basically resurrected Johnny and put him out there again, because he insisted to Taylor Hackford, if there's anybody that deserves to be in this band, it's Johnny Johnson. And Johnny got rediscovered. Mm-hmm. I love what Eric Clapton said about Johnny's performance at the Fox Theater in 86. He said, "For me, Johnny stole the show. He tore it up. And he did. And everybody's like, where's this guy been?
Yeah.
Where was he? Tell that story. Like, he was, did you tell me he was driving a bus?
He was driving a senior citizen's bus to make a living. He wasn't even making, here's one of the greatest boogie-woogie and blues pianists ever, but he's not making a living
playing music
as a musician.
Yeah.
So there's kind of parallel stories that are happening in the mid-1980s. Keith Richards had a conversation with Ian Stewart, who was connected to the Rolling Stones. He did some recording with them and some other work. But Ian Stewart's role in this story is that he was a piano aficionado, and he was the one who told Keith Richards and Mick Jagger, that piano player with Chuck Berry that you admire so much, that's Johnny Johnson. And so that was the first time that Keith Richards heard Johnny's name. Mm-hmm. He'd heard the music. So fast forward to the mid-1980s. For some reason, Ian Stewart pulls Keith Richards aside and says, don't forget, Johnny Johnson's still alive and playing in St. Louis. You need to go find him. And Keith's looking at him like, there was no context for that conversation. Mm-hmm. And Keith's like, what are you talking about? Well, not long after that, Taylor Hackford calls Keith Richards. Hey, I'm going to make this film about Chuck Berry turning 60, and I'd like you to be the music director and put together a band. And he immediately thought about that random conversation with Ian Stewart. So when I sat Keith Richards down at Electric Lady Studios in New York, Greenwich Village, and I said, knowing what you know now, what do you make of that strange conversation with Ian Stewart? And he thought for a moment and he said, Ian sent me to St. Louis to save Johnny.
Wow. Wow.
Okay, so there's that part of the story. When Richards insisted to Taylor Hackford that Johnny Johnson needs to be in this film, Hackford said, we don't even know if he's been playing. You think he still has it? And Keith Richards is like, he's Johnny Johnson. Of course he still has
it. You don't lose it.
So there's that part of the story. What no one knew was that a few months before Johnny got the invitation to be in the film, he was sitting in with a group of local musicians. And they took a break, and he very humbly got everybody together and said, hey, would you guys mind if I joined your band? And they're looking at each other like, you're Johnny Johnson. You can do whatever you want. And they, those musicians became the Johnny Johnson Band. And suddenly Johnny goes from playing very little to playing 3, 4, 5 nights a week. Well, nobody else knew that. So by the time Johnny started rehearsals at Berry Park in Wentzville with Eric Clapton and Keith Richards and Joey Spampinato and Steve Jordan, he was razor sharp.
That's great.
And he got to show that, yeah, indeed, he still had it. And that film changed the rest of his life.
Let's take a quick break and come back and talk some more. We're talking to Art Holliday and Ron Waterman about Johnny Be Good, the movie about Johnny Johnson, upcoming. I'll say this before the break, though. Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll is a movie that if you can't call yourself a true musician if you haven't seen it. If you've ever been in a band or ever want to be in a band, watch this movie. It's one of the most awkward, dramatic, amazing movies ever made about music. Just unbelievable. When Keith Richards is in it and he's the voice of reason, like you need to see this movie. Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. My friend Art Holliday is here. He's the director of Johnny Be Good about Johnny Johnson, who backed Chuck Berry, and many believe at least gave Chuck a lot of his ideas and inspiration for all the great music that he wrote, which led to rock and roll, right? Ron Waterman is the producer. Rach, I think you are in the position of a lot of people listening right now that you didn't know a lot about this, right?
I did not. And it's so interesting to hear you guys talk about this because I mean, what a person that needs to be celebrated and needs to be recognized for their contributions. But then you wonder, like, how many other Johnny Johnsons out there were there that didn't get a chance to be showcased in this way? So I think it's really cool that you're doing this.
You know, that's an interesting point, because there is a whole subgenre of music documentaries that has evolved over the last dozen years or so. Standing in the Shadows of Motown, 20 Feet from Stardom, The Wrecking Crew, Muscle Shoals. Those documentaries are about session musicians and sidemen and background singers who are the backbone of the music that we buy, but we don't know their names.
Yes.
And so there is an audience for that type of film, and that's exactly where Johnny B. Goode fits in. Because most of the people listening to my voice have heard his piano playing, but they don't know his name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a damn shame. So to make a movie, any movie, but especially something as expansive as this, you need time, you need talent, you need resources, you need money. And so you may be raising some here in the near future. How do people help?
So what I would say is, because I can't give all the details right now because we haven't worked them all out, but save the date on your calendar, October 16th. It's the 40th anniversary of the Fox Theater concerts that became the backbone of the movie, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. But for the purposes of my storytelling, that's the turning point of my film, because it changed Johnny's life. He got rediscovered. He put a band together, started touring, and had a whole second career very late in life. What I would say is, while Ron and I and the rest of our team are working out all the details, is if you are interested in this story, and if you are interested in supporting this story, because ultimately it's not going to happen with a lot of community support. And I've already had experienced that over the years, so I think it's probably going to happen again. JJTheMovie.com is the website for the film. You can contact me directly. When it's time to make the big announcement, we have a huge email list. If you just go on there to the contact page, you can get in touch with me directly. I'll put you on our email list, and you'll know about the event that we're going to have to celebrate St. Louis's music history, celebrate two of St. Louis's most accomplished musicians, Chuck Berry and Johnny Johnson, and try to figure out ways to pay for this film.
Yeah. We're going to raise some money.
Yeah. Sure. I hope this isn't a thorny issue to bring up on the air, but has the Chuck Berry family, do they have any issue with this? Are they salty at all about it? Shouldn't have asked.
No,
I knew it.
No.
One question,
well,
too many.
All I can tell you is that I met with Chuck Berry once.
Yeah.
And I explained that I was doing a film about Johnny Johnson, because Johnny actually introduced us. We went to Blueberry Hill. And, I said, I'm looking for three things. I'd like to interview you. I'd like to license your music. And I'd like for you and Johnny to play together and let me videotape it. So he gave me all of his contact information. And I left that meeting thinking, I think we made some progress. He made it clear subsequently that he was not a fan of this project. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. Yeah. So Ron, 2028, you think?
2028.
Okay.
Yeah. We have to put a flag in the ground and work towards that.
Yes.
What I've seen is an amazing story that can be told, and it's just a matter of, raising the funds to get us over that finish line. And we're not far.
Yeah.
Not far. I mean, this man, Art Holliday, has done an extraordinary job interviewing. I mean, he's got 110 hours worth of interviews,
yeah,
like with the who's who of music.
Yeah.
And all of those folks are like, this man is this amazing figure. And so We just need to translate that into the public.
Yeah, it's going to be a treasure.
I'm just looking at the website here, jjthemovie.com, and I'm looking at the merch store. I feel like this would probably be a great way if people wanted to contribute to. You guys have some really cool merchandise associated with
this. Well, thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Check it out. Always good to see you. Love me, love you, my brother. So I'll see you in a couple months.
Thank you for supporting Johnny B. Good. Thanks for being part of Team Johnny.
You bet. You got it. Nice to meet you, Ron.
Nice to meet you.
Dave Murray's Weather is sponsored by Sandberg Phoenix Law Firm. I wasn't ready to do it, Dave. I had to fade out.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, it's okay. Here we go.
Guys, it's the last day of our grandson's visit, so can't be with you live today. Whew, but the work continues, and so does summertime. It is sunny, hot, and humid again on Tuesday. I think we hit about 97 degrees. It's not even close to a record, and the record Tuesday is a really old one. It's 104 from 1881. That is going to be safe again. Tuesday night, very warm, very humid, 90s for evening plans, 79. Wednesday, not a lot of change. There's a front to our north that's going to try to settle down over us, though it's going to be a real struggle, this particular front of this particular summer. So Wednesday's partly sunny, hot, and humid. Be a couple of spot thunderstorms around 97 degrees. We'll do it for the high again. Some spot thunderstorms Wednesday night. Thursday, the front, I think, is going to probably settle right over us. Partly sunny skies, but it's still hot and humid on Thursday with a few thunderstorms scattered about. 92 for the high on Thursday. So it's a little bit cooler, but it is still summertime. Still think we have a shot of temperatures in the upper 80s come Friday, though that's a long way off. It's going to be a real watcher with this front to see how much power it has to get through. It's going to try to break the dome of summer, but this one is going to be a bit of a struggle. Stay cool. Talk to you tomorrow.
Too bad Dave couldn't be on. I know he and Art worked together for years, so that would have been fun.
Yeah.
Unless they had beef, then it would have been really fun.
Dave's here stirring it up.
Just going at each other. What I can do now is I can text him and be like, hey, Art was on. He said you were a real jerk. And then Dave will be like, oh,
let me tell you some stories.
Let me tell you something. Rach, I thought of you when I saw this story. I'm not sure how I feel about it. Dandelion is a cat, was found on the streets with severe anemia by volunteers at a cat sanctuary. And they found out that their therapy cat, Carrots, was a suitable match. Luckily, the transfusion helped stabilize the 11-year-old kitten, and now Dandelion is doing much better. Carrots is also blind. I feel bad for Carrots, who didn't know what was going on, and they just made her give a transfusion for the other cat.
Yeah, I feel ya. But, I mean, you know, she probably got to go to sleep, get some nice drugs. I think it's fine.
Yeah, Carrots don't know. Carrots can't even see.
It's really nice that she was able to do that for the new kit. You said an 11-month?
Week.
Okay. Oh. You said year.
Yeah. You did say 11-year-old kitten.
And it's like, yeah. No, 11 weeks.
I mean, I've heard of 11-year-old.
It's a big
children,
baby.
But
yeah. It's a tiny little thing.
Yeah.
I have a new cat obsession on TikTok.
Yeah?
The cat's name is Tinker.
Yeah.
I actually sent a video to Andrew this morning. And Tinker's owner is an Australian woman, and she's like, my darling, Tinker, come outside. And just the way she talks to her is so funny and cute, and then Tinker is very funny and cute. Highly recommend if you're able to find that on the old TikToks.
You guys seen the Zuckerberg yacht story?
Yes.
No.
So I think I even brought this up on the air last week. I'm not a big follower of billionaires. I'm not a big get mad at billionaires person like my good friend Kevin Wheeler.
Only the ones that act like jerks.
But I saw Zuckerberg's yacht and it just pissed me off. I'm just like, you shouldn't have that. I'm sorry. But while people are dying of starvation, you just shouldn't have it. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And Rach, help me out with this story. I think what happened was his yacht was sailing without him or his wife. And saw a boat that was in distress, and the people were stranded, and they just kept going.
Yeah, they So Meta is now saying that the crew of the Zuckerberg yacht did not hear the radio call to assist the boat. But previously, the story was that they basically ignored and declined the distress call.
Mm.
But now they're saying, like, we didn't hear it. We didn't hear. We were just...
They probably don't have very good
aren't there systems in place to make sure that you do hear that? Like, wouldn't I mean, that's one of the laws of the sea, right? Like, you are bound to help a stranded vessel if you're in the area and your vessel is operating. I thought that was like maritime law.
Okay, I was wrong to say distress. Let me read this quote from Meta, which, as we know, they would never lie. They would never say anything.
They wouldn't spend it.
Mark and his family were not on board at the time of the incident. As the Coast Guard noted, the boat was not in distress, and by the time the crew reviewed the Coast Guard contact on a different radio channel from the one they were operating on, the assist was already underway. We're grateful all parties are safe. But a passenger on the cruise ship had said on social media that the authorities had radioed Zuckerberg's yacht and they repeatedly refused to respond. So it's really seeming like a he said, she said type thing.
Well, who stands to lose if the accusation is true? Well, I mean, obviously it's Zuckerberg. And if he wasn't there, it's not on him personally, but definitely on the crew, right? So which version of the story you think they're going to tell us?
Can I just stop you there? How long have we been working with Kevin? 2 years?
3 years?
3 years?
Almost 3 years.
You are an SNL skit or a Larry David episode. With the way I've never heard anyone in my life do the rhetorical question that's not a rhetorical question.
I'm actually leaving space for you guys to jump in and you never do. Y'all just like stare at me.
It's a rhetorical question.
When you do it, it's really hard to know, like,
right.
I don't know what to do with the rhetoricals.
Either.
I'm like, that.
Because this has happened several times in the past. Kevin would go like, well, who stands to lose if this story is true?
I don't know.
And I'll wait like 2 seconds. I'll start to go, Zuckerberg? He's like, it's Zuckerberg! And I'm like, oh, I didn't know the timing. I don't know what to do.
You don't leave a lot of space for someone to jump in. Because you go like, who stands to benefit? Zuckerberg! And it's like, well, that's...
Well, if it was that quick...
Let me get my thoughts in order.
Hold on. If it was that quick, you guys wouldn't feel weird about it. You'd just be like, he's talking.
Right.
Yeah.
So there's a pause in there that's long enough for someone to say something.
Yes.
No, it's because the pause follows a question mark.
That's what happens after a question. You wait for someone to answer. And since I'm...
But it's not clear if you want us to answer.
Of course I do.
You've been speaking uninterrupted for like 2 full minutes, and then you ask a question and pause for 1.5 seconds.
This is the clash of two radio worlds.
That's exactly what it is.
100%.
This is a person who has been a solo host for a long time and people that don't do it that way. And when I ask a question, one thing as a solo guy, silence is deadly. You cannot just stop talking. But in a group, you can. So when I do the pause and I don't hear an answer, my brain goes, you got to start talking again.
So just for
it's
all
a
of
habit.
This, you would like an answer.
Of course.
Okay.
I mean, it's not like a demand. It's just throwing it out there, and in a solo host's brain, silence is not okay. So if there's no response, well, then you got to go. That's how the brain is wired from doing it that long.
Gotcha.
Can we go back to the story really
sure.
quickly? I'm actually going to do a horrible thing, and I'm going to side with Meta.
Wow.
I actually believe the crew of this yacht giving like an official like, yeah, we didn't hear it. I believe them over... Now I'm seeing the original report was just someone on the cruise who posted to social media. Like, how would they even know? If it's just a random cruise passenger and they're like, they have repeatedly ignored our calls. Like, what? I don't think that's not like a I can't verify that. If it's just a random cruise passenger, it kind of seems like someone maybe just trying to get attention online.
And she loves billionaires.
That's not what I'm saying.
Hey, he wasn't even there.
I'm just saying, like, it does... Like, this wouldn't be a story if it was anyone else's yacht. If it was a billionaire whose name you didn't know, this would never show up in
the
news.
It's definitely celebrity TMZ news.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
You guys want to know what the throw-up in The Exorcist was?
Corn.
Yeah, it was like
corn.
Was it corn?
Corn.
It was not corn.
Was it pea soup or something like that? It was some kind of a mixture of stuff, right?
Together, you and Kevin nailed it.
Oh.
It was a soup from a famous California restaurant called Pea Soup Anderson, mixed with oatmeal.
Oh!
Look at that. Just,
you know they got a ton of that pea soup because someone on the crew liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, well, we'll get a bunch and we'll have that for lunch. And then whatever's left over, we'll just mix that with some oatmeal and that'll be the vomit.
He probably spilled it on the floor because he's an idiot. And then everybody was like, well, I guess we'll just have to make the movie around it.
Yeah, she was originally, she was not going to throw up.
He just tripped walking on set like, no. And they're like, hey. We just got to do a rewrite.
Well, that would be like good. If we were shooting a movie and we were like, you know, I think we need some Capital Grille tenderloin sliders.
Yeah.
We're going to use that in a scene.
Yeah.
Like,
we need some Capital Grille lobster mac for vomit.
Yeah. Like, how strange to use a specific restaurant's pea soup.
Yeah, they said it was superior to Campbell's.
In appearance?
That's not hard to do.
Because I would imagine the flavor wouldn't matter if it's just being thrown
onto
the
floor. No, I think appearance, yeah.
Okay.
I don't think they cared that Linda Blair liked it or not.
Linda. Tinka.
Hey, Linda, come get your pea soup.
That's some hoose pup right there.
Something tells me they didn't care about Linda.
They call this a pea soup.
Linda going to eat this pea soup real good.
She is, and she's in trouble.
I thought I read something about this.
Yeah, she either had 150 or 250 like dogs.
Animal hoarding.
Oh,
yeah.
That's sad.
But what I heard, because she and I met, and it was magic.
Mm-hmm.
What I heard was the dogs were very well taken care of. It wasn't like a kind of situation where like the Humane Society has to come and clean them up and stuff.
So she had a staff taking care of them and stuff?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. It's more like an animal farm.
Oh. That's fine. There's no problems with that.
Yeah, nothing that bad ever happens at Animal Farm.
Welcome back, DGS on KMOX. Top of the hour. Skip will be here. We'll be doing the Sweet 16 of sauces and condiments. That was our executive decision yesterday, me and Andrew. Mm-hmm. Rachel, you want to do a couple headlines?
Yeah, let me get that pulled up here. I don't know why I said it like that. Sorry, I just wasn't expecting to do it. La da da, we're almost there. Okay, the Bank of America is splashing out $250 million a year on weight loss drugs for its staff.
No.
The CEO says we see a great impact on our employees, and we've always been about mental wellness and physical wellness.
Who's doing that?
Bank of America.
Oh, cool.
I mean, also, you would think it would have positive health outcomes.
Yeah.
Which could also reduce costs on healthcare. Good.
Here's a local story real quick. Will Scharf, you guys remember him? He ran for Missouri Attorney General.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He works for the White House. He had been staff secretary and head of the National Capital Planning Commission. But now he is going to work as White House counsel. The president named him White House counsel recently. So, Missouri boy.
I don't like that guy. And it's just that he's Trump's guy. He could be the nicest guy in the world. I mean, he's a douche, but I mean, he just is. Undeniably. He's a douche.